morning, and welcome to Cosmetic Surgery and Permanent Makeup, another installment in our Medical Halacha / Medical Ethics series. This one will be a hybrid. It has elements of it that are more ethics oriented, and elements of it that are more straightforward in terms of Jewish law. I want to thank once again Bayit Adult Education for co-sponsoring with us, as well as Dr. Kirshen for enabling us to get credit through University of Toronto. Please make sure that you sign in. Afterwards, I do send up a follow-up email, which includes a link to the audio recording where you can find it online. The video will be on KosherTube as well. But I also need to be able to send out a link for a Google form that we use for an evaluation afterwards. It's a short evaluation, but we do need responses as part of the accreditation process. Okay. So we have quite a bit to cover, so much so that I chose not to go with vignettes for this class as much as just to tackle the topics themselves, because there really is so much to deal with. So what we're going to start out with is the issue of elective cosmetic surgery. And I stress elective cosmetic surgery as opposed to somebody who has a bad burn or cases that, as you'll see, don't really fit the paradigm for the elective one. The elective one is the one that I get the most most questions about. Once we discuss the elective surgery, then we'll move into the discussion of permanent makeup, micropigmentation, which is a rather different discussion. So we start off with the elective cosmetic surgery, and you have to divide it up into two different categories. One, elective surgery in general, having nothing to do with the cosmetic side of it, but a person who doesn't require surgery, choosing to have it anyway. And then second, the issue of cosmetic surgery in general and the pursuit of beautification. Those need to be broken out, even though, as we'll see, there's overlap between the two. So when we're talking about elective surgery, what are the concerns? What would you expect would be the considerations regarding taking on oneself a surgery that seems not to be required for the sake of preserving one's health? Potentially causing need for pikuach nefesh, in other words, endangering yourself. That will be one consideration, because all surgeries do involve danger, whether we're talking about fear of infection, whether we're talking about anesthesia, whether we're talking about just being in a hospital where infections can be circulating. So that's one concern with elective surgery. What's the other concern? There's a second concern that also has to be taken into consideration. Undergoing surgery means wounding oneself, right? Or asking somebody to wound you, because presumably you're not doing this on yourself. But
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt. Elective surgery, as we understand it, is something is done with the patient in optimal condition, not in an emergency. But what surgery are you referring to other than plastic surgery that is not necessary? Because I don't think any surgeon would operate on anyone.
Right, but that's exactly what I'm referring to, is the plastic surgery case. Now, when we talk about cosmetic surgery, the case that I have in mind is the case of somebody who is in otherwise perfect health. Now, we're going to have to talk about psychological need also. That's going to be a part of this.
You're only talking about, because there is no, I don't believe there's any other surgery other than plastic surgery.
Right. But in any case, I mean, that's actually the case I have in mind, is the person who says, I don't like the shape of my nose. Right.
Okay, so aside from plastic surgery, that's what I understand.
Right. Oh, no, I didn't, no, I, that's exactly what I'm talking about. So the two issues that we have to deal with are the issues of entering into danger and wounding oneself, or inviting somebody to wound yourself. So let's talk about the danger issue first. It is commonly understood that all surgery will involve an element of risk, and the Torah says, among other verses we could marshal for this, we are obligated to protect our health. A person is putting themselves into danger. That would seem to be inconsistent with protecting one's health. However, there is a recognition that a human being is allowed, by the from the perspective of Torah, to enter into risks that are considered to be worthwhile. They're in the middle of the table there. Yeah, that are considered to be worthwhile. And we know that because we're here this morning. Right? Everybody here left the house this morning and somehow got to shul. And whether you walked, or whether you took a bicycle, or whether you took a car, there were elements of risk involved in each thing that you did. Right? Even in getting up in the morning, if a person has blood pressure issues, getting out of bed will involve a risk. But we all did it. We take planes. We drive cars. We, you know, touch the banister in the subway. Whatever it is, there are risks involved in life. And that's just something that you're expected to deal with. And the understanding within halacha is that risks are okay within certain parameters. Take a look at source number one, please, on your sheets. The Gemara in Bava Metzia. The Torah here is talking about something that we've actually discussed this in other contexts. The Torah here is talking about the mitzvah of paying one's workers on time. And in stating the importance of paying one's workers on time, the Torah says, this poor guy, literally a pauper actually is the way that they frame it, puts his life on the line in order to do your job. How dare you not pay him on time? They love who knows say as nafsho. For that salary, this person puts his life on the line. Mibnema ala zeba kevesh v'nisla ba'ilanu masaras atzmo lemisa. They're envisioning someone who works at heights. Why did this person climb up a ramp? Why did he suspend himself from a tree? Why did he put himself in a life-threatening situation? Lo al schara, was it not for his wages? And the Gemara assumes that he's allowed to do that, that a person is allowed, in fact, to become a construction worker in order to earn a living. From this we understand that one is entitled to enter into risk in order to gain a particular worthwhile benefit. So if you take a look at source number two, Rabbi J. David Bleich wrote, although every therapy is fraught with danger, the hazards of treatment are specifically sanctioned when incurred in conjunction with a therapeutic protocol. In other words, every medicine involves an element of risk, right? Look at the box and you'll see what the side effects are. Every surgery involves an element of risk, but generally speaking, if it's in the pursuit of health, it's approved. Accordingly, he says, the practice of the healing arts may be permitted even if designed simply for the alleviation of pain. He's not dealing with cosmetic surgery per se. He's dealing with the broader question of what is allowed and is not allowed. And he says that we do permit people to engage in therapeutic acts even if an element of risk is involved. Rabbi Yaakov Breisch, the Chelkas Yaakov, writing, as you see, in 20th century Switzerland, applies this for elective surgery. He says, "Mavur b'Shabbos Lamed Beis, the Yoledes b'Cheska Sakana." He says the Gemara makes clear that it considers a woman to be in danger when she is in labor. That's an assumption, and you know, for much of human history, that's been a very strong assumption. So the Chalkas Yaakov writes, "Hachiyala al adas lomar de isha ena ruuya li naseyu laholid banim if neisha machnisa atzmal sakana liyos yoledes." So are you going to tell me that a woman is not allowed to get married and have children because, after all, she's putting herself into a position of danger? Kachu min hago shalolam. He says, this is the way of the world. It's considered normal. It's considered a normal and acceptable risk. Now, the question then becomes, what if it's not a normal risk? What if there's a woman for whom pregnancy is high risk? And then maybe the calculations change. He's not assuming a high risk pregnancy. So he says, the kevan de dashu barabim shomer psayim Hashem. He quotes you the phrase that Gemara uses. Since this is something that everybody does, it's considered to be normal human behavior, Hashem guards those who are foolish. If we're foolish for entering into this risk, God takes care of us. V'harbe matzinu b'shas le'inyin sakana. We find that all over the Gemara. V'hashu d'dashu barav m'shomer psayim Hashem, where the Gemara makes, in fact, this declaration. V'hachinami, so he says here too, le'inyin is as far as this issue of the elective surgery, kevan dikvar dashu barav m'leilech laharofim, since many people do this, they go to the doctor, Even though surgery is considered to be dangerous, Shomer Psayim Hashem, the Einenu Rowan, Baruch Hashem, Sheruba Deruba Mehaf Kola Im Shaosun Lahem Nituach, Hashem Yatzilenu, Misrapim. He says, thank God, we in fact see that the vast majority of people who go in for these surgeries actually do get better. So the statement there of Ebraish makes is that you're entitled to go in for elective surgery. You are required to make sure that it has this kind of high percentage of positive results. There's a difference between going for a board-certified surgeon who's going to do an acknowledged procedure, as opposed to going to somebody in their apartment who's having a Botox party, right? You have to know, you know, something about what's being done. You have to do your proper research. Whatever system you're going to work with in order to define proper, safe, effective, that's what you have to pursue in order to be justified in doing this. However, it's not quite so simple. And this is going to take us a little bit into the discussion about cosmetic surgery versus the elective question. So there's going to be a sort of blurring of the lines between the two issues. But going back to source number one, we said this fellow climbs the tree, climbs the ramp, hangs himself from the tree, puts his life on the line for the sake of his wages. Part of the Gemara's assumption is that he's doing it for his wages. What if he said, I'm not doing it for that? I just like to go hang from trees. Would the Gemara necessarily be as positive about taking the risks? Let's say I'm not a construction worker who likes to climb the scaffold on the bridge, right? Because he's doing it to get paid. I'm just somebody who's looking for a thrill. Is it then allowed? What would you say? The Gemara would seem to say no. Yeah, sorry? It gives him a lot of satisfaction. That's a really interesting question. When we deal with the laws of Shabbos, and we say, Pikuach Nefesh overrides Shabbos, saving a life overrides Shabbos, and even Suffolk Pikuach Nefesh, even if it's just a maybe, right? We're not willing to tolerate a level of risk and say, well, wait till after Shabbos is over and then go to the hospital. So how are we allowed to turn around then on a Tuesday and say, I get a thrill from bungee jumping? Or, you know, whatever other pursuit may involve a level of risk. I'm not so sure that we should be allowed to enter into a level of risk that we wouldn't tolerate on Shabbos just because it's a thrill for us to do it on Sunday. Yeah?
How do you draw such a line?
So that's a good question, right? How do you draw such a line? I think the first step in drawing such a line has to be defining what the risk is that's involved. Meaning, I actually don't know what the risk is in bungee jumping. It sounds like fun. I don't know what the level of danger is, both in terms of danger within the act itself and possible health, you know, back problems or whatever. What do I know? You're all the doctors in the room. I'm not. But I think your first step has to be defining the level of risk, and then your second has to be defining the level of reward. There's a very concrete reward when he does this for a living. He's able to put food on the table. That's very different from the vague, I get a high from mountain climbing. So I think that's a very important consideration here, especially if we're going to take it back and apply it to the cosmetic surgery case, in terms of figuring out what the risk is versus what the reward is. Is this somebody... Well, let me hold off on that for a second. Leah, and then Dr. Nussbaum. Yeah.
Also, when you go bungee jumping, you know, they probably give you all these sheets of all the risks and everything that you read. And so I guess, and I think typically on Shabbos, if someone's ill, firstly, usually it's not, you're usually in charge, you know, it's a family member or someone, so it's not yourself. You're saying, I'm not taking that risk with someone else's life. You're saying, I'm calling 911. And often the people involved may really not know... you know, what the outcome could be, so they're like, I don't want to take the risk, I don't know what's going to happen.
True.
So I think it's a different situation.
Well, no, because you can just restructure the situation. What if it is for yourself and you're medically aware? You know, what if an adult...
You may not call. You may say, you know what, this can wait till after show.
Okay, but I think that's an open question. I don't think it's... I, I don't think that I think, let me put it this way. I think people who want to engage in risky behavior on Sunday have to ask themselves what level of risk they would tolerate on Shabbos. Assuming that they knew what the risk was and so on, would they go to the hospital or would they not? Because you have to ask. If I take life seriously, then I have to take life seriously across the board. I can't play games. Dr. Nussbaum and then Dr. Lipman.
What about joining the IDF and, let's say, joining the mind-diffusing division?
Good question. So then you have to ask, what about people who put themselves in harm's way for other purposes? Dr. Nussbaum mentions joining the army, joining the IDF in particular, right? And becoming a mind sapper, right? Which I think also is one of those high-risk pursuits. On the other hand, when we look at what the reward is, in terms of saving lives and potentially saving, when we talk about being a soldier in the IDF, saving large communities, then that has to weigh in on the reward side. These are all calculations that have to be made in a particular case. I'm not saying regarding any of these pursuits, yes or no, but I'm saying that this is a halachic concern that we have to have. Dr. Lipman.
Now, we mentioned that you're allowed to actually have this for pain. Are we
right. So that's one of the steps we have to get to still, is the question of applying. That's where I was about to go when I took questions, is this issue. So, good segue. When you're dealing with the question of risk versus reward, psychological pain absolutely has to be part of this calculation. However, as doctors who are working in this field know, getting the surgery often isn't going to solve the problem. If you're dealing with somebody who has a self-image issue, right? If you're dealing with somebody who has, some psychological issue which is being expressed via their discomfort about how they look, getting the surgery isn't going to be a corrective. There's a difference between the person who requires the surgery because they have a particular problem which needs to be solved, and the person who has, I don't like the way I look, as the driving force, which is why I think in general it's recommended, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think part of the protocol is for people who go for this sort of a surgery to actually meet with somebody first for some level of counseling about this. Right? Is that still the norm?
If someone really does have a disfiguring nose, it's kind of going to make, I get it, okay, fine, I think it's just done, because some things are actually almost
yes.
And everyone gets it. And so then it's done, I think, without psychological counseling, and often they do feel better. They are much more positive, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. So that's really where you get into a debate. And the debate fundamentally is, how do I look at the pursuit of beauty? And again, it may not be the pursuit of beauty. It may be the pursuit of looking like everybody else does. But that's part of this question which has to be addressed. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, that sits Eliezer, was very against. He was not a fan of surgery for the sake of achieving a particular beautification. If you take a look at source number 4, he says, Barur de'ein locha ela chidusho. That's a principle the Gemara uses when you use a verse to teach a lesson, but the lesson is really dramatic. And in permitting something I would not have expected to permit, so the Gemara will say, okay, but only permit that which you specifically learn from the verse. It works for being strict also. So he says here, you could only permit the most minimal things for this. He says, "B'makom shachavala ba kedei larapos ulahashiva veidas gufo." He says, "Yes, you're right. We will permit people to get wounded in order to heal themselves. So, an amputation for somebody with a gangrene case, he says, yes, that will allow. However, only where it's actually an act of healing. He says, as opposed to wounding for the sake of beauty." He says, "You're not restoring the loss of the body. What you're doing is wounding the body to change it so that it'll look the way one wants it to look. You're going to be wiser than God. God made the person this way and you're going to change it. Or to restore one's youth." It's my birthday today. this is very appropriate. No, that's enough. But he says, "Velistorik zeras malko shel olam." I like that, restoring one's youth. He says, "Velistorik zeras malko shel olam," or to contradict the decree of the Creator of God. Vel achas kama vekama dinala mikol safek shaasu la adam bechleit lachnis es atzmo avur kach l'shum sakana kol shehi. He says, "Absolutely not. One is not allowed to put himself in any danger for this kind of pursuit." The Tzitz Eliezer is very negative. Others are not as negative, unsurprisingly. Rav Moshe Feinstein gave a specific head. There is specific leniency in the case of a woman who was having a very hard time in the dating world. And the consensus of her friends, whatever, was that there was a particular disfigurement that was keeping her from being able to find a shidduch. Now, that's a very risky thing. That's a very risky path to take. Not for her in that case in particular, but if you're going to tell people to engage in surgery in order to be able to find a spouse, oh boy, is that a can of worms. That's a dangerous game. But the overall concept is you have to ask yourself, why am I doing this? And does it justify in potentially endangering oneself? Is it like the salary of the construction worker who maybe could have found another job, maybe couldn't have found another job? It depends on the economic environment, background, training, and so on. But that's one concern that has to be addressed. The second concern, which goes hand in hand with it, is the wounding concern. Fundamentally, you're hiring somebody to cut into your skin. And generally speaking, that's not allowed. The Gemara in Bava Kamma, source number 5, I'm not going to do this one inside, you can see it there, decrees that one is not allowed to engage in activities which are harmful to one's person. There it's talking about the Nazir who refrains from drinking wine, but the general principle is that one is not allowed to engage in activities which involve wounding oneself, harming one's person. And on this Gemara, Tosfos notes that this is true even if there is a benefit. So I'm not allowed to say to somebody, walk up to somebody on the street and say, punch me in the stomach. And he says, no, I'm not allowed to punch you in the stomach. I say, somebody promised me he's going to give me $50 if you punch me in the stomach. I'm still not allowed to ask him to do that. You're not allowed to wound yourself. That's a basic principle in Judaism, regardless of the benefit. Ari.
Is this the rationale behind tattoos as well?
Oh, no, we're going to get to tattoos. Tattoos are a separate biblical prohibition, even without the wounding discussion. Because as we'll see, the wounding can be overridden. The tattoo would not be subject to the same overriding principles. Yeah?
How is it permitted for women to have pierced ears?
Good question. So how is it that you're allowed to have a pierced ear? So if I remember correctly, I haven't looked at the pierced ear issue in many years, but if I remember correctly, that part of the ear is not considered to be wounded. If I remember correctly, it was because of the part of the ear. I don't mean wounded in terms of medicine. I'm talking about within halachic definition of wounding. I don't mean medical definition of wounding.
Because of
Sorry?
If somebody wants to stay, you can have their beer. But maybe there'd be a connection that would make it much easier.
Right. You know, believe me, this is a good reason to sign in, because I like to send out follow-up emails. I'm going to look back at the issue, because it's been many years since I looked at it, and I need to check before I say something. Right. Well, the fact is that you find it in the Torah. Meaning you find in the Torah men and women wearing earrings, nose rings, you know, they existed. The question is, so how do you get there? Why is that? Okay, and I'd rather look it up than say something that's a guess. The justification when you deal with wounding, where we said you're not supposed to wound even for benefit, the justification is where it is for healing. Because we will redefine the act as not an act of wounding, but an act of healing. So the amputation would be, you know, the extreme case of that. But that's the principle. Take a look at source number 6. You know there's a prohibition against wounding a parent. What happens if the child is the only one available to take care of the parent's medical need, and it involves cutting into the skin? So the Rama writes, or Moshe Isserlis writes, regarding bloodletting, He says, I'm going to just do the English in the interest of time, but you can see the Hebrew as well. Where no one else can do it, and the father is in pain, the son should let blood and cut him as he permits. If the father allows it, the kid is supposed to do it. It's not a life and death case that they're talking about, but the case is mitigating pain of the father, and that is considered to be justified. And the reason is, as Moshe Feinstein writes in source number 7, he's dealing with the plastic surgery case, or the cosmetic surgery case. He says, it appears there is room to permit this woman in the case at hand to beautify herself, even though it occurs via wounding. Since the wounding is not performed in a manner of victory or humiliation, meaning that the way the Rambam frames the prohibition against wounding somebody, he describes it as beating somebody up. There's some debate about the correct text in the Rambam, whether it's an issue of degrading somebody or whether it's an issue of defeating somebody. But Rav Moshe writes, it's very clear when you're talking about the surgery, it's done for the person's benefit. Therefore, it's not classified as an act of wounding. It's classified as an act of healing. That's the justification for it. And there are various examples of this going back to the Gemara. Once again, you have to ask, so how far will you go to consider something an act of healing? What about the person who experiences psychological pain because they don't like the way that they look? Will you consider this to be an act of healing? And again, that's going to go to the case-by-case type of an analysis, but that's the factor that has to be considered. So when we're dealing with elective surgery, any elective surgery, oh, and now I remember what I had said, aside from plastic surgery, because I wanted to stress that it's separate from the plastic surgery issue. Even if you can't come up with another case, my point is the plastic surgery as a subject divides into two areas: the fact that it's elective and the fact that it's cosmetic. So in terms of the elective side of it, you have to ask, is this a risk that people normally take? And what is your corresponding benefit that justifies it? And you have to ask, in terms of wounding, is this an act of healing such that we won't call it wounding at all? We'll actually say that it's justified. That's all under the roof of, the umbrella of, elective surgery. But then there's a second question, which is really an ethical question, which is the question of cosmetic surgery. And again, we're talking not about the burn patient, the patient who has been disfigured in some kind of a traumatic incident. We're talking about the person who doesn't like the way their nose looks. So the question then that we have to ask is it okay for me to pursue beautification? And here we have two separate ethical issues that are brought. The first one is one that I'm going to mention, although I think the ship has sailed on this one, really. But nonetheless, it has to be mentioned, which is there anything wrong with correcting God's work? The Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Waldenberg, said, you think you're going to be wiser than God? God created a person with this form, and you're going to now alter that form. So is there anything ethically wrong within Judaism for a person to improve upon God's handiwork?
Well, you're allowed to correct a squint, so why not?
You're allowed to
correct a squint.
You're allowed to correct a squint.
But that's functional.
Okay. The argument, maybe that's functional.
Nowadays, yes, but it used to be cosmetic.
All right, what?
But we need different types of cosmetic, just the nose. How about like liposuction? Somebody will wait if they have to eat well. Trying to let them do that.
Right. Well, you may be getting into separate health issues, right, which are no longer cosmetic then. The question that was asked was, what about the patient who wants to go for liposuction? So, I don't know, maybe he's carrying around weight that's bad for his heart. I don't know whether the health issue is involved also. But otherwise, yes, it's going to be the same fundamental question, you know, to be asked. I mean, there you will also that may be why they're in this condition. It may not be why they're in this condition, right? There are all sorts of reasons for obesity. Yes?
You're using the principle of God created the person the way he is. Are you allowed to do surgery if it is functional? Let's say somebody has a genital orthopedic problem. Are you allowed to correct it?
Right. So then the question is, how would you distinguish between this surgery and that which can correct some other congenital problems? Which my answer would be, that's verapo yirapeh. Right? We have specific license in the Gemara to say, don't tell me, well, God made this person this way. Who am I to heal them? We are specifically licensed to heal. The question is, does this transcend healing? However, the reason I say the ship has sailed on this is because we have many sources that support the idea of human intervention to improve our world. I brought you the Maharal in source number 8 as an easy one. Just as nature operates at divine decree, and nature functioned during the 6 days of creation as is appropriate for nature, the same applies to the actions of a person, meaning picking up after the 6 days of creation, with his brain which is above nature and with his deeds which are not of nature. In other words, what the Maharal states is that Hashem created us. He gave us our abilities and powers. He gave us a brain that could figure out how to do these surgeries. He gave us the ability to make tools that will help us in the surgeries. Fundamentally, this is natural also. This is not called an unnatural intervention. And the Rav of Soloveitchik talks about in Lonely Man of Faith, the pursuit of creativity as a means of emulating God. There is plenty of material you could bring to bear to demonstrate that it's okay for humans to engage in, so to speak, improving upon God's work. This is not the major question. The other question that you ask is a more significant one, which is beautification an appropriate pursuit? From a Jewish perspective, should somebody say, without any particular practical issue, they're not disfigured, they're not suffering, you know, from a deviated septum affecting their breathing, you know, through their nose or whatever it is, just, I want to look different. Is it okay for a person to say that? Dr. Shaheen? So the Shidduch thing I mentioned before you got here, the consideration, which, as I said then, goes both ways. On the one hand, saying that's an important justification, and on the other hand, saying if we're going to set up a precedent for telling people that you need to get surgery in order to find a spouse, we're going down a very dangerous road. You could really make the argument both ways, depending, I think, on the level of need. What kind of surgery are we talking about, you know, for this person? The gut reaction, when you approach it, is to say, well, this is shallow. Sheker achein vehevel hayofi, we're told in Mishlei that beauty is false and it's vain and so on. At the same time, you can't ignore the fact that Tanakh, as well as the Gemara, emphasize the beauty of our imahot, right? The beauty of our mothers as well as some of our fathers. Right? Both Rachel and Yosef are described as being of great beauty. We're going to be reading Megillas Esther next Motzai Shabbos. We're going to talk about the beauty of Esther. You know, beauty is taken in the Gemara as a sign of righteousness. It's taken as a sign of being close to the divine plan. Right? The Gemara talks about how Chava was incredibly beautiful because she is God's handiwork. And you can't compare her to any human being. But Sarah was also beautiful, just not as beautiful as Chava, and so on down the line. And beauty is recognized as important within Halacha. There are laws, for example, to allow beautification during Avelus, during a period of mourning for a bride. Because of the recognition that it does matter. The reason, yeah. Sorry?
What about for men?
So I'm going to come back to men in a bit. I'm conscious of the distinction that I'm drawing by saying it this way. That's why I threw in Yosef, because I needed a male in there. But you'll see why shortly. You'll see why there's a distinction shortly. But the fundamental reason for valuing beauty is because of a shiur that we had here a couple of years ago, which is the issue of kavod habrios, human dignity. We respect and value greatly human dignity to the point where, as source number 9 notes, it's a Gemara in Brachos, we will override rabbinic prohibitions in order to preserve the dignity of a human being. And there are all sorts of examples of this that come up. My favorite example, brought in the Mishnah Berurah and in the Shaar HaTzion on the Mishnah Berurah, is that if somebody has something stuck in his teeth on Shabbos and he can't get it out, he's allowed to use his hands to shape a piece of wood to use as a toothpick. And today we have toothpicks, so we're not really in this position. But in Rodin, 100 years ago, it wasn't so easy. They were out of toothpicks at the store. So so you could, because shaping the wood in this way, using your hand, is a rabbinic prohibition rather than a biblical one? One will be allowed to do so in order to pick his teeth on Shabbos because it's embarrassing to be in front of people with food in your teeth. So we have this concept of valuing the dignity of the human being, and on that basis, we will be concerned about one's appearances and say that you may be justified in pursuing surgery in order to improve that. There was a hand here somewhere. Yes? True, although there the question is if for his sake or for the sake of the Mishkan. Right? In other words, it's the beauty of the temple rather than the beauty of the individual, potentially. However, you always have to go back to the other pole. There are always two poles, which is, how far are you going to go in claiming beauty? Separate context. There is a mitzvah in the Torah of Hashavas Aveda. I am responsible to restore lost objects to people. If I am walking on the street and I see a scarf and I know the scarf belongs to so-and-so, I am responsible to pick it up and return it to them. However, there is an exemption. And the exemption is that if it will be beneath your dignity to do this, then you don't have to do it. So, for example, if you find a tennis ball in the mud, right? And you know it's the kid in the house. You saw him playing with a ball before. You know that it's his, but you're not somebody who would pick a tennis ball out of the mud for yourself. It was your ball that was in the mud. You would just say, I'll leave it there. I'll get another one. Then you don't have an obligation to go take it out of the mud in order to bring it to the kid who lost the ball. We do have a limit. So on this point, Rabbi Bakshi Doron, in source number 10, says, the honor of an individual who decides to honor himself and be arrogant, refusing to carry a sack or a box to return it, is based on personal calculations. He can't thereby exempt himself or override a rabbinic prohibition. Just the opposite, he should conquer his character and not cancel the mitzvah. In other words, we're not opening up human dignity to everybody's personal interpretation. There has to be some recognition that there's a community standard, and the individual doesn't get to define, well, this is my dignity. And for me, this matters the way that your dignity matters to you. So we're identifying poles rather than answering for a particular case and saying that on the one hand, we value human dignity and therefore we do value beauty and therefore one might well be justified in pursuing this surgery. On the other hand, there has to be a limit. It has to be what the community in general would recognize as dignity. And the result of this is that you have great debates. You find some authorities, for those who read Toronto Torah this week, you saw the chief rabbi article, I think Rabbi Ziering wrote it this week, on Rabbi Yaakov Ariel. Rabbi Yaakov Ariel's stance is that you could only engage in elective cosmetic surgery to correct that which is considered to be a defect, not to improve on that which is considered to be normal. That's his standard. Rabbi Waldenberg doesn't want these surgeries at all. He would like to see nobody engage in such surgeries, as we saw before. He says God is the artist. If you don't like his work, take it up with him, but don't pursue surgery. Rav Moshe was Megill was lenient in the Shidduch case, that where there was somebody who felt and her friends felt this was what was holding her up, and therefore he considered that sufficient justification. So now the question becomes, why are we focusing on the women? Why is it that our examples of beauty were Chava, Sarah, Rachel, Esther, and all we can muster on the male side is Yosef? So what is it about this? There is a biblical prohibition against a man wearing the garb of women. That's a basic rule. It's a rule against cross-dressing, maybe suspended on Purim. Ask your local Orthodox rabbi. But there is such a prohibition. I brought it for you in source number 11. A man's implement shall not be on a woman. A man shall not wear a woman's garment. And the Gemara applies this to pursuit of beauty in particular. Says the Gemara in Nazir Daf Nun Tes that talks about for a man to remove the hair of his armpits as one example. The Gemara in Makos talks about for a man to pluck out white hair from among black hair so that he'll appear to be younger. The Gemara in Shabbos talks about scraping one's skin in order to beautify it. I don't know exactly what this was, whether it bred into the skin having been scraped or somehow or other, it would make it more attractive. And this is broad. There are tshuvas, there are responsa on the issue of dyeing one's hair, whether a man is indeed allowed to dye one's hair. All because historically and culturally, this was considered to be, this concern for beauty was considered to be something that women did. It was not considered, from a cultural perspective, something that males did. Mirrors were used by women. Mirrors were not used by men. Mirrors weren't available for a very long time. It's more recent in terms of our history than the time of the Gemara. But the point is that in general, from a cultural perspective, beautification was considered to be a feminine pursuit. That has changed. And the commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch already note that when they talk about the issue of what is considered a man's garment versus what is considered a woman's garment, the statement is you have to follow whatever local practice is. And local practice doesn't mean Jews. Local practice means human practice. So when I was a kid, they told us in school that earrings were something that women wore. This was, late 1970s. They said, this is something that women wore in late 1970s, early 1980s New York. I'm not so sure that that was true then. It's certainly not true anymore, that earrings are of one gender. It wasn't true at the time of the Chumash either. It will change over time. So the same thing is going to be true when you're dealing with this beautification question. So that there are actually three different justifications for males. One justification is if one is greatly upset and ashamed regarding his appearance. So in source number 12, I brought you Menashe Klein's tshuva on this in the Mishnah Halachos. He deals with the issue of cosmetic surgery for a male, and he says if there is a mark on one's skin which is such, it has such an impact on him that it embarrasses him and he's afraid to be out in public, then he would be allowed to engage in the surgery. That's one justification. A second justification is where there is a very practical benefit. It's not really done for cosmetic purposes at all, but it's actually a practical issue. And then the third example of it is once the activity becomes a standard activity for males. So I brought it in 13 and 14. This is what I had referenced before. 14 in particular, the work of the Prisha, Rabbi Yeshua Falk, writing on the Torah, which is an early code of Jewish law, he says, common practice is determined by general human activity. Not only Jewish activity, but non-Jewish activity. But in answer to your question about why are we mentioning males, historically, historically, beautification was culturally viewed as something that women did rather than something that men did, and the halacha has to take into consideration what happens when it becomes a male activity as well. So what we've seen under this heading of cosmetic surgery is that you have to look at the question of engaging in elective surgery in terms of putting oneself in danger. Do I have an associated benefit that justifies the risk, and is the risk low enough? Do I also have the ability to call this medical, such that it justifies engaging in being wounded? And do I have the justification of beautification as an appropriate pursuit? Is this something that we will look at as being proper? And the answer is, if it fits in the rubric of dignity, then yes. And then the last bit for the males, is this something that guys do? That's basically your set of issues that we've discussed. Before we move on to permanent makeup, questions or comments on that? Yes.
Also, when you mentioned culturally, and you said non-Jews also, I'm a little surprised. I mean, it's good that we take into consideration what's happening in the world, but if we look at popular culture, it's gone out of control. So
right.
So
I mean,
how much does that go? Like how much?
Because we're not talking about determining our conduct and right and wrong based on what the world does. We're looking at defining two words, male and female, or maybe that's a better way to say that. Male and female dress. We're looking at defining what is normal for males to wear, normal for females to wear. So you have to remember where this comes from. There are two basic understandings of why the Torah prohibits this cross-dressing conduct. One is the Rambam's approach, which is that it has to do with idolatry. Because in idolatrous rituals, the male priests would put on a female garment, the females would wear a male garment. It had to do with channeling the forces of their deities. And that's one consideration. The other consideration is the concern for trying to pass as the other gender or to mingle with the other gender in an inappropriate and intimate way. But looking at male beautification under the banner of taking on what women do, we don't want the male going into the place where the women are being beautified, you know, undergoing whatever this is, and hanging out with them. If that's my concern, then you have to ask, well, is this in fact the province of women, or is it the province of both? And for that, it isn't about what Jews are doing, it's about what general society is doing. You're right, the idea of defining our halacha based on what popular practice is can be interesting and have interesting ramifications, and it really is something that's unique to this particular area of law rather than something broader. Yeah?
Because also the idea of changing cultural standards is a very slippery issue.
Yes.
Because the Rav was very opposed to talking about something historical, halakhic decision based on historical circumstances, but aren't we talking about historical circumstances here?
There's a difference between defining, as I understand it anyway, between defining halacha based on historical circumstances and addressing a halacha which is dependent on contemporary reality. Meaning, there's a difference between me saying pig isn't kosher, and the reason it's not kosher is because it was dangerous to eat back in the day, now it's not dangerous anymore. Or, well, I think that's a good enough example, I need to go hunting. There's a difference between that and the fact that halacha always depends on knowing what your practical reality is. That's true 100% of the time. There is no such thing as a case you can answer without knowing the circumstances behind it. So if the question is this an act of preserving one's dignity? You need to know what dignity is. And in order to know that, dignity by definition is based on what the population does. So it's it will be like trying to answer a medical question without knowing the patient's condition, right? Should I take this medication? Well, what's wrong with you, right? You need to know that. That's the difference that I would draw between the two. It's worthy of a longer discussion, but it's not going to be right now. Dr. Shahin, you were waiting.
So, a lot of times I mentioned dress like women, but men aren't doing the surgery to look like women. They're doing surgery to look better as men.
Right.
Is that halacha really relevant?
Right. So the issue is engaging in a feminine practice. It's the issue of the practice rather than passing as. And I think the theory is that the men who are engaging in this practice are going to be mixing among women in doing so. But yes, it's an interesting question. Is it that we're concerned about looking like, or is it that we're concerned engaging in the practice? It seems from the application of this, which is brought in various works of halacha, that even engaging in their practice would be, you know, in the practice of the opposite gender would itself be problematic.
So what are you defining as a part that's exclusive to women? Because men unify with a man combing his hair, or...
So there were periods in history when actually no. Like standing in front of a mirror and brushing your hair would have been considered a violation of this. Like I can show you Sifrei Halacha that talk about it. It's not, you know, that's what today is normal hygiene wasn't always considered normal hygiene. He's supposed to look unstained. Meaning although we do try. Now it's part of the tests for smicha. In all seriousness, the standard there is that he shouldn't have revev al begado. He shouldn't have a stain from the meat that he ate on his clothing. It's not that he should go out and try to acquire finery. There is a distinction between the two. Peter, and then
so. Part of there's a theme of conversation here about dignity and embarrassment.
So dignity goes hand in hand with embarrassment. But you've been describing dignity as more of a community view of what is dignity, what's dignified. But the embarrassment is always in the part of the person who's affected, and you've given an override to always dignify that person. So if that person is feeling embarrassed in any way, what does it matter whether the community or the norm has any impact on that? Therefore, if they are feeling embarrassed or feeling undignified by whether it's food in their teeth or hair being a little bit out of place or a slight blemish, surely then it all falls down to that individual feeling about themselves, whether they feel embarrassed regardless of what the norm is.
Right.
Because they need to be dignified.
Right, to which Rabashi Doron will respond that intuitively we understand that there has to be a limit to what we're going to accept, that otherwise people could take this to the nth degree.
Which they do.
But there's an understanding that there has to be a threshold of batla daito etzal kol adam, where we say that even if you hold yourself to be unique, that doesn't change the halacha. The halacha is based on what's considered to be normal. I understand your point, but I think that's the halachic response to it. Well, yeah, and then we're going to go further. Yeah.
One of the reasons that we don't donate out open is because we're supposed to be very full, right?
Not necessarily.
Okay, and a lot of people are donating an open, so I thought that was part of the, you're supposed to be very full.
I think...
Then also you do damage to yourself by donating an open, but what is there no concept of this, like if you do plastic surgery, you're removing a whole bunch of skin and fat and whatever you're...
So as I understand it, no. It isn't an issue in terms of burial. The only thing I would note is that in general, if someone has a limb amputated, not talking about cosmetic surgery now, then it has to be buried. That's true. But not like, no, for, they're not burying whatever is extracted in the liposuction. That's not the...
No, but I'm talking about cutting off like a whole bunch of...
Right, but no, it doesn't affect, as I understand it, it doesn't affect the burial discussion. It's a good question, but I don't think so. But yeah, the organ donation issue is beyond the burial issue. Okay, so let's talk about permanent makeup. And the truth of the matter is, this has nothing to do with the cosmetic surgery discussion at all. But because we were talking about cosmetic things, and this is a thing, it's a practice people ask about, so we put it in together with the cosmetic surgery discussion. I gave you two references in the notes, number 15 and number 16. Number 15 is a great article by J. David Bleich on the issue of tattooing and micropigmentation. I highly recommend it. It's available at that website. And then the other is I gave a longer shiur on the topic of micropigmentation on a Monday night a while back, and I dealt with more than we're going to have time to deal with now, because that was a one-hour shiur devoted to this topic. So the link to the audio for that is in number 16, if anybody is interested in knowing more. Basically, what is micropigmentation? We're talking about taking a needle and using it to deliver pigment into the lower layer of skin. According to Rabbi J. David Bleich in his article, this practice started in the mid-1980s, where they tried to tattoo people's eyelids to produce permanent eyeliner. Now, the term permanent is a misnomer. Right? It's not actually permanent. It lasts, by the estimates that I've seen, 2 to 3 years, maybe slightly longer. It's not literally permanent. That may not matter within halacha, but that's the reality. So what I want to talk about in terms of micropigmentation is micropigmentation of the skin, as opposed to where it's done internal to the body, or as opposed to where it's done for for medical purposes, like to aid a surgery where you want to show where the surgeon is supposed to cut or which side is supposed to have the surgery. That's not what we're dealing with. If you're dealing with medical necessity, then it's fairly easy to permit. The concern that we're talking about now is the issue of somebody who would like to have their skin colored via what is essentially a tattoo. And the Torah says explicitly, you're not allowed to have what's called in the Hebrew, in the Torah, ksoves ka'aka, which I'm going to translate for the time being as a writing of engraving. You're not supposed to engrave in your skin in order to write. So the question is this going to be okay, or does this run afoul of the biblical prohibition against tattooing? Are we clear? So the basic approach to this within halacha is to ask, is this a biblical prohibition, or is it a rabbinic prohibition? And the reason why that matters is because if it's rabbinic, then it may be overridden for a case of kavod habrios, for a case of human dignity. For example, somebody was in a in a fire or whatever, however it happened, they don't have eyebrows anymore. And that can be a terribly embarrassing thing. So they would like to have eyebrows tattooed via this this procedure. If it's only rabbinically prohibited to have such a tattoo, then it will be permitted to do so for this purpose. And in fact, there are poskim halachic authorities who have written on this topic and have indeed permitted it in that case. There's also another reason to knock it down to a rabbinic prohibition. This is a fascinating point which requires longer discussion because it's a broader halachic issue. I'm only mentioning it. Rabbi J. David Blythe points it out from the Chasam Sofer in source number 17. We have biblical prohibitions before we see it inside his text. We have biblical prohibitions, and then we have rabbinic prohibitions. Very often, the purpose of a rabbinic prohibition is to keep people from violating biblical law. So the Torah says, don't do X, and the rabbis say, don't do Y, because it could lead to X. What if you have a prohibition which is itself... Well, let me... The problem is they need to give you the cosmetic surgery case, because it's really the greatest example. What if you have a prohibition which is a biblical prohibition, and then there are numerous ways to turn it into a rabbinic prohibition, and a person is going to engage in the activity, the prohibited activity, in such a way as to trigger multiple rabbinic prohibitions? I can see already this is not clear. Let me try it this way. Let's assume for the moment, we're going to come back to this, but let's assume for the moment that the biblical prohibition against tattooing is specifically if you first cut the skin and then fill it in with ink. But if you first put ink on the skin and then you cut, that's only a rabbinic prohibition. Let's say that that's true. We're going to come back to that. Let's say the order matters. So then I could tell you that if I get a tattoo where I put the ink on first and then I cut, I've only violated a rabbinic prohibition. But let's say as well that it's only a biblical prohibition if you write letters. But if it's just a picture, it's only rabbinically prohibited. So then you'll say, okay, so it's rabbinically prohibited to get a tattoo that is a picture. Well, what if you get a tattoo that's a picture and you put the ink on the skin first, and then you make the incision? So now it's rabbinic in two different ways. You follow where I'm going here? So the idea now may be, the rabbinic prohibition against doing it in the reverse order was only stated if what you're doing is itself biblically prohibited, not if it's a picture. And the rabbinic prohibition against getting a tattoo that's a picture is only if you do it in the order that's biblically prohibited, but not if you do it in this other order. In that case, what we call trei derabanan, it's a double rabbinic prohibition, it may not be prohibited at all. The rabbinic prohibition was only created for a case in which the act itself, sans this change, would have been biblically prohibited. Take a look at Rav Leich's wording. Now I think it may be clear when he says this. He's explaining the stance of the Chasam Sofer. And he says, the logic underlying the Chasam Sofer's position is readily grasped. Rabbinic injunctions are quite specific. The sages interdicted only specifically delineated categories of behavior. Those categories, according to Chasam Sofer, are not overlapping. The sages prohibited indelible laceration, and they also forbade utilitarian tattoos. And those are categories we have to get to. But they did not enact an additional and more comprehensive edict prohibiting tattoos that are at once utilitarian and unpigmented. You'll see his specifics when we get there, but you understand his point. If I can show that a tattoo that we're talking about, the micropigmentation, is rabbinically prohibited rather than biblical on multiple counts, then it may not be prohibited at all, because the rabbinic prohibition was not created for such a case. Keep this in mind. once we've seen some practical examples, I think it'll be more clear. Okay, so here we go with our discussion. Number one reason to knock it down to a rabbinic prohibition is the issue of the order in which the incision and the dyeing are done. Take a look at source number 18, please. Hakosev Ksoves Kaka. The Mishnah is part of a series of Mishnayos that list the prohibitions of that list various prohibitions. So one of them is one who writes Ksoves Kaka, Ksoves Kaka. And it says, Kasav Velo Kiaka. If somebody writes, but he doesn't do this ka-ka act, which seems to be the engraving. If you write on the skin, but you don't actually cut into the skin, or ki-aka v'lo kasav, or it cut into the skin, but you don't write anything, there's no ink, eino chayav, he's not liable biblically, ad she-yichtov ki-akeya b'dyo, until he both writes and cuts with this ink, or ubikhol, which is another type of a dye, ubikhol davar shuhu roshem, or anything that makes a mark. So one point that gets seized on in this Mishnah is the order of things. Rashi, in source number 19, says, if one first writes on his skin with an ink, and then engraves his skin with a needle or blade, and the dye enters between the skin and the flesh and remains visible forever, that's what is a tattoo that halacha is concerned with. If you write first and then engrave, and he gives you an old French word for it, and then he says, one may not write anything on his flesh in this manner, for the Torah's text has decreed it. So Rashi says, it's actually not Rashi, I should note, Rashi at this stage in the Gemara and Makos is actually the Rivan. It's not Rashi, but it's written as Rashi's commentary. Fine. The point is, it is an early view, it's a serious view, and it says the biblical prohibition is pigment first and then cutting. On the other hand, we get the Rambam Maimonides in source number 20. And he says, no, the ka'ka script mentioned in the Torah is that one cuts his flesh and fills the cut with coal, ink, or other marking dyes. It was the practice of idolaters. We're going to come back to that point about idolatry. But look at his order. Cuts his flesh, and then fills the cut with ink. The exact opposite of Rashi's position. There actually is a third position, which we're not going to get into because it doesn't seem to be taken seriously, but it's to inscribe and then cut and then pour in ink, but I'm not going there.
Is a needle considered cutting?
So the needle is considered cutting because you make a cut in the skin. However, the needle may have the ink with it, so that they're actually simultaneous. And that's gonna matter. So the question is, when Rashi, or Rivan really, writes that the biblical prohibition is where you write and then cut, and Maimonides writes is where you cut and then write, are these specific and exclusive? Do they really mean to say, and if you do it in the opposite order, you haven't violated the biblical prohibition? So Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, the Bach, in source number 21, commenting on the tour, says there's no difference in the order. Don't get hung up on what the order is. Both of these are biblical violations. He says the proof of it is in source number 18. Source number 18 was our Mishnah, and it talked about writing without incising, and incising without writing, and it didn't seem to care at all about what your order was. So the Bach's position is, the order doesn't matter. Why then would one choose one order and the other order? So he says, because Rashi used the language of the Torah's text. The language of the text is Ktovet Ka'aka. Right? Writing of engraving. So that's the order. Writing first and then engraving. Not that that's the only case of the prohibition, but that's why Rashi used the language in this way. Whereas the Rambam chose to do it the other way because that's the way people make tattoos. The normal method of tattooing in 12th century Egypt, possibly even still today, is that first you make the cut and then you fill it with ink. Is that the way tattoos are still done? No? No one knows. Sorry? Simultaneous? Okay. They, in the Rambam's day, they were doing it simultaneously. That's the, that would be the idea here. So we don't really care, according to the Bach, about the order. There are other ways to explain this position. Rabbi Bleich has his own way to explain the different orders that appear. But more important for us is that not everybody agrees with the Bach. Others disagreed, including Rabbi Menachem Meiri in source number 22, and said, no, the order does matter. He says, one who writes ka'aka, cutting his skin and then filling the incision with kachol ink or one of the marking dyes, first cutting and then putting in the ink, like the Rambam, like Maimonides. He says, this was like a law for the idolaters, that's what they used to do, and that order is specific for him and for others, which led Rabbi Leib Ettlinger, in his work, Shomer Tzion HaNe'eman, to argue that actually, if you use a contemporary system in which the needle is coated with the ink, it's only rabbinically prohibited and not biblically prohibited. And again, the reason I care about that is because then, if someone needs it for the sake of their dignity, it's a rabbinic prohibition, it can be overridden, like in the case of the person who needs the eyebrows. But that's leniency number one. I'm actually, in the interest of time, I'm going to go through this first, and then come back to take questions so that people are able to leave, if they need to. We're at 10 minutes short of time. That's leniency number one. Leniency number two is in terms of the style of tattoo. Go back to that Rambam that I gave you, the text of Maimonides. The second half of what he said in source number 20. He said, tattooing was the practice of idolaters, marking themselves for idolatry as if to declare that the bearer of this tattoo was a slave, sold to the idol, marked for its service. That's the way the Rambam describes it. Now, very often you present a reason or a lesson of a mitzvah and it doesn't shape the mitzvah. However, some take this as being specific to the mitzvah to say that it's only if it resembles the tattoos of the idols that will actually have a biblical prohibition. That's the argument that some bring. Now, not everybody agrees with the Rambam on this branding of not everybody agrees with the Rambam on the branding of the prohibition as being about idolatry. But the Rambam has a good source. Take a look at source number... Actually, don't take a look at it because I didn't bring that piece of it. Number 23 was where I was going to refer you to. But the truth of the matter is that Tosefta, I omitted the part of the Tosefta that supports the Rambam that says that it's only related to the idolatry. But the... Sorry? Oh, I did bring it. I brought it at the end. There's a stronger sin. But all right, yes, this is good enough. You're correct. The Tosefta says it. For those who aren't familiar with Tosefta, it's contemporary with the Mishnah, but not canonized with the Mishnah. So you're talking about a text that's a couple of thousand years old and considered to be important in the chain of halacha. And it says, the latter half of the text, Ve'eino chayev asher yichto v'yikakeya b'dyo u'b'kochel la avodah zarah. You're only liable if you do it for the sake of idolatry. Now, that's actually subject to debate. However, it exists as a principle on the books, and Maimonides seems to accept it when he stipulates the idolatrous element. And that leads me to multiple potential heterim, multiple potential permissions, or at least reductions to a rabbinic prohibition. Number one, if a person uses micropigmentation in order to restore the natural color of the skin, a person has some kind of an ailment that causes their skin to have a blotch that doesn't look like it normally would look, and they're going to use micropigmentation in order to make it look like the rest of the skin. So I'm not on the eyebrow case, it's a different case. Rabbi Shraga Feivish Schneeberg, a rabbi in London, makes the argument that this will be okay. I brought it for you in number 24. And he says, if the whole purpose with the idolatry is to send a message for people to be able to see the mark, then I'm going to make the argument here that people are not seeing anything. If the micropigmentation goes well, no one looking at the person will be able to see any mark. It's duck is supposed to blend in. It specifically is something that's supposed to blend in. It's not supposed to look like anything else. Rabbi Bleich thought that was a very hard position to support. Number one, because not everybody agrees with Maimonides on the idolatrous base of it. But number two, because you'd need a body of responses that support the idea that a tattoo is okay if it doesn't actually look like anything, if it looks like the regular skin. But it's an interesting idea. A second idea, what if you have a tattoo that does not actually convey a verbal message? The idea of being branded for the idolatry, the argument goes, was not being branded with a picture, but being branded with a text. If you take a look at source number 25, the Sefer HaChinuch, when he lists the mitzvah of not having a tattoo, not tattooing, the prohibition in his list of mitzvot, he says if one writes even one letter on part of the body in the manner described and so on. But he says if you write a letter. Now Maimonides did not specify letters when he wrote this. He didn't say anything about letters. But they all do use the term writing, including Maimonides. And so you have a debate as to whether it's biblically prohibited if it's a picture. It might only be rabbinically prohibited. That's a second potential permission. And again, it's highly debated, but it's out there. The third is, what if the tattoo has a practical function? Maybe that's different as well. The Gemara talks about something called Efer Makle. It's in source number 26. There was a practice that if someone had a wound, they would put ash on the wound. But they had a concern, because the same sort of ash was used in tattooing. And so the question is it okay for a person to use this ash on his wound? And in source number 26, Rav Ashi ruled it's okay. Because when you look at the wound, when people see there's a wound there, they understand this isn't a tattoo. This is a person with some kind of a wound, and this is being used medicinally. So the sages ask, why isn't this considered to be a tattoo? Why does having the wound there help? And Rabbi Bleich puts forth an idea based on a text of Rabbeinu Yerucham in source number 27. He says, one may place this ash on his wound, for his wound demonstrates it's not for idolatry, and this is obvious. The point is not about cut to the chase. The point is that you want to make sure that no one will mistake this thing for idolatry, and the ash is shown to not be for idolatry by the fact that there is a wound present. It will make a mark, and you can even have a permanent mark out of it. However, you're okay, because it's there for a practical purpose, which is healing this wound. And so Rabbi Bleich makes the argument, and it's supported by source number 28 on the case of the ash, that maybe if it has a practical function, like restoring a person's eyebrows, maybe that will be considered acceptable. So again, let me make sure that this is somewhat clear. I know I'm rushing this part of it. Let me make sure that I sum it up. You want to make sure that you want to see if you can reduce this from a biblical prohibition to a rabbinic prohibition. The idea being that if it's rabbinic, it will be justified for the sake of human dignity, as well as if it's rabbinic on multiple counts, it may be permitted. If you're going to tell me that writing something that is only a picture and not letters, and doing it with the ink and the inscribing simultaneously makes it now a double rabbinic prohibition, it may actually be permissible entirely. I should also note, if it's only rabbinically prohibited, you may be okay having a non-Jewish technician do it. If it's only rabbinically prohibited, it's not prohibited for the non-Jew at all. There's nothing wrong for him to do it. But the prohibition against aiding him as you turn in a certain way to help him make the mark may not apply if it's a rabbinic prohibition. So knocking it down from biblical to rabbinic has practical ramifications. So the arguments go, number one, the order may matter. Then number two, the style may matter. If it is ink and writing, if it's ink and cutting simultaneously, or certainly if it's ink first and then cutting, that may knock it down to a rabbinic prohibition. And If it's non-verbal, meaning it's not, it doesn't involve words, doesn't involve writing, it's just a picture, or there's no visible mark. In fact, you're doing it, you know, to make things look like there is no visible mark. Or if the tattoo has a practical function, it may be reduced to being rabbinically prohibited. Now, when you deal with this in practice, there is a broad range of views contemporarily. The leniencies tend to be in the cases of need, the case where there is some kind of a disfigurement which is being corrected. They lost their eyebrows, they have a blotch on their skin. That tends to be the case where there's greater leniency, as opposed to the person who says, you know, it's a nuisance to keep on applying makeup, I'd rather just have this this color there permanently. There are fewer who are willing to permit. But there really is a range of views. Give you just a little bit of the range so you know. The views that say it's prohibited, the Kol Eretz Chemda in Israel, the Shevet Halevi, Rav Wozner, Chabad actually records that many prohibit. Rav Nosson Gishtetner, the Haraz Nasan, they don't like it. Then you have those who say better not to do it in general. But there may be grounds to permit in a particular case. Rav Asher Weiss, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu are in that camp. And then you have those saints permitted. Rav Avigdor Nevensol of Yerushalayim, Rav Avadia Yosef, they tend more towards the direction of permitting. Rav Yaakov Ariel, who I mentioned earlier, also leans more towards permitting. So you really have this range of views that surrounds this question, all because it doesn't quite do what tattooing does. It's not quite the same way, it's not quite the same thing, and that's why we draw the distinction. One last note, because I do get this question sometimes, if someone does have this permanent makeup, it's not a chatzitza for mikvah, it's not an interruption. They wouldn't have to worry about this being a mikvah problem in the way that makeup can be. So I will now take questions if people want to ask anything. We said an hour and a quarter. It's now an hour and 16 minutes. So if anyone has to leave, I am not insulted. Yeah.